Kirsten Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
Hello, Marjorie, Jim. It's Election Day. Special Election Day 2013. I voted this morning at 7:01. Have you voted or not, Marjorie Egan?
I am proceeding directly from the studio at 2 o'clock right over to my voting
You are, I hope. Are you not doing that?
Oh, around there.
But you are going to vote, correct?
Of course.
Okay, so based upon Marjorie's promise, we will be the outliers. Listen to Bill Galvin. He's the Secretary of State yesterday at the State House. He's seen a distinct decline, he says, in absentee ballots, especially on the Democratic side. Here it is.
About 20% behind the number of absentee ballots that were requested in 2009. It is my belief, based upon that, that the turnout will be below the 669,000 that we saw cast in 2009.
And let me translate for that for you. If Bill Galvin is right, that means that fewer than one in five eligible voters, registered voters, are going to vote today. And we want to know at 877-301-8970. If you're part of the vast majority who plan not to vote today, we want to know why not. Now, we were just joined by Emily Rudin. Now, even though, Emily, you are not wearing your I voted little thing.
They knocked for me one today.
Whatever.
That's right. That's very suspicious,
Emily. You voted this morning, right?
I did.
How was that?
I was one of three or four people there. Oh, thanks, Edgar.
And I was actually, Edgar's going to join us in a second here. I was actually, when I went into my polling place immediately after it opened, there was not one person voting when I went in. And when I, this is Cambridge, mid-Cambridge, pretty sort of a hotbed of small D and large D democracy, I guess. And not only one person I encountered on the way out. I mean, that's pretty pathetic, is it not?
Yeah, it is. But I had an issue, as you know.
That's shocking. What was that?
I did. I found this, I mean, I thought we had corrected this whole thing. You walk in there, and the woman asks your name, and I say, Emily Rooney. Oh, I know you, she says in a very loud voice. And then she says, Democrat or Republican. And I'm looking around thinking, what? Why do I have to say that?
Oh, you're unenrolled.
I'm unenrolled. But why don't they just give you one ballot? It's like voting. It could have the red and the blue, top, bottom, whatever. You just fill out one thing. Why
and if you fill out both things, it's disqualified.
And then they put a big X on whatever one you asked for. And it's like, wait a minute. Remember a few years ago, you used to have to then re-enroll as unenrolled?
Yes, you did.
Now you don't have to do that anymore.
A little discretion.
But why can't they fix this?
A little discretion. They shouldn't be shouting
out. But
wait.
If you're not unenrolled, which is the majority of voters, it's the unenrolled are a greater number than actually Republicans and Democrats combined. They know if you're enrolled as a Democrat, it says on a public record you're a Democrat, and it says if you're a Republican. So why shouldn't we know how you voted? I mean, which party you voted in? What's wrong with that?
Why do I have to tell them?
You mean tell them, meaning the vote? Well, it's going to be public at some point, right? I mean, if you chose a Democratic ballot.
If you go in and vote in a general election, nobody knows how you voted. They don't know whether you voted Democrat or Republican. Why should they know?
Especially when
you don't have a good answer to that.
I don't. I'm thinking about it, though. I'm going to come up with it in a couple of minutes.
She was there in her pajamas, too, and they made a spectacle out of her voting.
You know why I was upset with
embarrassing.
The reason Emily's story upset me is when she said, I'm Emily Rooney. They said, oh, you're Emily Rooney. I said, I'm Jim Browdy. Silence. 877-301-8970. Come on, man and woman up here. If you are part of the 80%+ of registered voters who apparently are not going to take a ballot today, just tell us why. Why? Do you not know there's a special election? Do you not care? This ridiculous article, this argument. We're tired of voting.
Oh, yeah, come on.
We've had so many special elections. Remember Boston Strong, how tough we are? I mean, really, we're so strong that we can't go out and vote on a primary day?
Remember the Iraqis, after they got to vote, they had everybody pictures with their thumbs with the little stains on them?
Threatened with death while they're waiting in line.
Yeah, they probably don't vote anymore either. That was a one-time only deal. Right? Am I right?
You know why it
was? 10 years ago.
Because when you're in line, they say, Sunni, Shia, which ballot do you want?
Chamber do you want to go to?
We're joined here in the studio by Edgar B. Herwick III, who's reporting back from Somerville, West Roxbury, and Brookline. What'd you find out
in
the hustings?
I found that you guys are absolutely right on the money. It is slow out there. That generally seems to be the mood in most of these polling places. In fact, all of them that I was in. I was in Somerville near Davis Square, which is where I vote. And then I was at two different locations in West Roxbury. I was at St. George's Orthodox Church, where there's precinct number 14 and precinct number 10, both voting there. Very slow there.
You were there at most of these places early, like pre-work times, I assume. So
not all of them.
But some
certainly
of them, which
in
is
Davis
when
Square
vote.
Was pre-work time where they were expected to be very busy, and it wasn't busy at all. And all of this is in contrast, don't forget, to the last time that these places held a vote, which was not just a presidential election, but also a very close Senate race here in Massachusetts. And it's sort of when I ask every one of these wardens that I was talking to, you know, how does this compare to last time? They get this look in their eye like they're about to tell me a war story, you know, because they're like, well, we came in last time, there were 400 people in line, we were behind all day, we never caught up. And this time it just sort of seems to be very slow, very steady. They've had little rushes in the morning, and they're all anticipating another small rush, you know, around 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock when people get off of work. But generally, very, very slow.
Did you
slow.
Stop numbers anybody on the street and say, hey, are you voting today?
I talked to people who were near the polling places, or generally were voting. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that, you know, it's a self-selected sample. They're already near the voting place, so they're going to be voting. But in Davis Square, which is busy, you know, and a lot of foot traffic, they had all of these parking spots that were set up. 15-minute temporary parking for voting.
Oh, good.
Nobody in any of the spots.
Oh, no.
So a completely... just completely empty sidewalk. It was very, very quiet in Somerville.
What about West Roxbury, the mayoral race? You mentioned before the show.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I was in Brookline and I was in Somerville. And Brookline's interesting quickly because they also have town elections. So it's helped increase their numbers.
It's dog-eat-dog in that town meeting
they're
race.
They're voting for constable. They're voting for school board.
Keith Lockhart was
his
wearing
wife.
A button for his wife running in district or whatever.
So there's
whatever,
all kinds of voting happening there. But as soon as you get into Boston, when I was in these areas in West Roxbury, there is easily twice as many signs for mayoral candidates as there are for any of the people who are running for Senate. And I ran into Dan Conley, mayor.
Oh, really?
Dan Suffolk Conley was running for mayor. He was shaking everybody's hand coming in and out of Holy
funny,
Name Parish.
Because I ran into Josh Zakim, who's not running, Lenny Zakim's son.
Oh.
And he's running for council
where?
Next fall.
Wow.
In Boston. He's running for city council. But he was the guy in front of the polling place.
Well, it's a great place to – and some of them are out there with their volunteers collecting signatures to get
all
mail ballots.
Well, it's not a great place
all
if no one's
are.
Voting. I mean,
it's better than Dunkin' Donuts because you figure you have engaged people out there.
You know, we're going to get to your calls in a second. Emily, my goal every morning when I get to GBH is to be more appalled by something than you are something else.
It's tough.
But I am really almost disgusted by the fact that virtually nobody is supposed to vote. Does that bother you at all? Your attitude is if you vote. You vote.
Man, my attitude
is
please don't vote if you don't know what you're doing.
Me
you
too.
Know, I don't
Me
have
too.
A big thing about everybody getting out there, you know.
Neither do I.
But a very, very, very small percentage of people are going to decide this whole deal, you know. First the primary and then the general. It's going to be just as small.
That doesn't trouble you? That I did the math last night, which I know everybody knows in their head. Between Kennedy and Curry, the two most recent incumbents, 37 years average they served, 46 and 28, as I think what the numbers were. These guys, with the exception, is Markey the oldest candidate, I think? I think he's in his mid-60s.
I'm not sure.
So it's likely that one of these men is going to serve for 20 years. And the notion that fewer than a fifth are going to decide who the finalists are and maybe a comparable number in a special election late June is horrible. You don't care. Okay.
Well, okay. I talked to one voter and she made a good point, I think, which is she said, look, if you don't vote now, don't complain later. Like, you know, that's sort of her attitude, which
we
I
get
think
the right
is,
to complain, Jim.
You know, if you vote, you can complain. And to your point, Jim, about turnout, you know, in precinct six in Boston, which is reputed as the busiest one, the busiest precinct in Boston, there had only been 180 votes as of 11 o'clock.
Wow. 180
that's
votes.
That's not very many.
But I'm
so it's going to be less than 20%, I bet.
I'm absolutely with you. I don't want people – that's why I end up not voting for half the people on the ballot in Brookline because I never heard of them. I don't follow town politics as closely as I should. But if you don't know the positions of people, stay home.
Wait a second. Yeah, exactly. You think the 550,000 projected Democratic votes, according to Galvin, they're all fully engaged or totally aware where Lynch and Markey don't agree on the issues?
I don't think they are.
Well, they care.
But
that's a good point, actually.
But I do think the idea that everybody should be hauled out there to vote because it's election day when they have no idea what the people that are running for office stand for is not a good idea
either. Well, but then the response to that is then they should do a little work. To understand
civic,
where people...
It's their civic responsibility.
I
give that lecture all the time.
That's what I was trying to say. You know, aren't there some... aren't there a few countries, like big-time countries, which have mandatory voting where 90-plus percent... You don't like that concept at all.
No, Sweden
might be one.
I don't. I do think
Did you know
they
can't drive a car with a ding in it in Sweden?
Is that really true?
Yeah.
And
oh,
you
God.
Know, what's that?
That'll eliminate me.
Wow. Yeah, I'm out. I can't. I will never drive
no
in Sweden.
No dings in your bumpers.
I will never drive in Sweden.
Let's take a few calls and see why people are not voting. That's who we're looking for. People who are honest enough to admit they are not, they are part of the non-silent majority and they're not voting. 877-301-8970.
Chris in the car, do you have an excuse for why you're not voting today?
Well, I don't. I totally agree with Emily that I want people to stay home if you really don't know what you're voting for, what their positions are. I hate that whole thing of no matter what, just get out there and vote.
Yeah, Jim.
I think it's terrible. And the other thing I want to say, actually the reason I called originally, is I also hate walking into a polling place where, you know, they do ask you, they bellow out loud, Democrat or Republican ballot, and I'm like, really? You don't just have...
This is WGBH 89.7, your source for local news and talk. We're Boston's NPR news and culture station.
The voting, right. Not how you voted or who you voted for, but whether you're a registered Democrat, Republican, or unenrolled, you know that's all publicly available information.
Well, yeah, but not to all of the people from my town
exactly.
Standing around me in little grade school where I'm voting.
Exactly.
Where I might be deciding I'm going to go ahead and vote something way off from what they might imagine.
Yeah, just say, give me that libertarian ballot.
Well, you know, especially, I mean, Chris, I live in Brookline, and I think there's probably three Republicans in Brookline. And if your kids are in the school, you almost worry they won't get picked for the cheerleading squad if you come out of the closet and admit you're voting for Gabriel Gomez. That's
well,
it.
It's like you get glared at by these people that you have to see in the post office the next, you know,
exactly.
An hour later. And, you know, I just don't really like that you have to. And they do. I think it's wonderful, the workers at the different polling stations. They're very, you know, proud, and they're civic duty, but they just can't wait to yell out.
Exactly.
Hey, Chris, Emily Rooney wants to know if you're available for a one-on-one 30-minute interview tonight on Greater Boston. Can you do that? Chris, thank you for a great...
9 times out of 10, I agree with Emily.
Great. Thanks for a great call, Chris.
One of our producers had a great experience this morning, too. Tonya.
Oh, this was unbelievable. You tell the story.
She votes in Dorchester, and she walks into her polling place, and they automatically hand her a Democratic ballot. She and her husband. Her husband's a Republican. And they just handed her two red ballots.
That
it's like,
great.
Wait a second.
Can I ask a question? Why are the Republican ballots the blue ones and the Democrat ballots the red ones? That's opposite of what you would expect.
It's because it's Massachusetts.
Right.
Yeah, Dorchester, you're outnumbered, you know, a million to one, Democrats, Republicans,
but,
too, right?
But the assumption.
I know.
It's pretty great, actually.
Outrageous.
877-301-8970 is our number. Emily Rooney, Edgar B. Herrick III, Marjorie Egan, and Jim Browdy taking your calls.
Michael from Worcester, thanks for calling Boston Public Radio. What's up?
I love your show.
Thanks.
My issue is, and I'm sitting here in front of the polling place, I don't like either of the two Democratic candidates. They're two old white men. I worked for Elizabeth Warren. I was excited by her. I just can't get excited by either one of these guys.
She's the same age as them.
Yeah, actually, she may even be a little bit older.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think Markey's 66 and Lynch may be 58.
And I'm 68, so it's not even fair that I'm saying
that. So what did you do, Michael? What did you do?
I'm sitting here and I don't know what I'm going to do. I think I'm going to go in
pull
a lever and not vote for either one of them. I honestly, we need young blood. I feel the Democratic Party are just shoving people down our throats.
Well, it's going to be email us at the end of the day and let us know who you voted for and why, Michael, at bpr@wgbh.org. Thanks for the call.
You know, if the polls are right, it's going to be very interesting. If Gomez does win and Markey does win, then this is going to be kind of a weird thing because Gomez is a very liberal Republican.
I wouldn't go that far. He's against every single one of the three central tenets of Obama's gun control. That's not exactly...
Yeah, but he's a very socially liberal Republican, and those kind of Republicans do well in Massachusetts. And he's also, you know, first-generation American and all those kinds of things.
He's a lot younger.
Well,
compared
not even younger.
You just hear a voter right here saying that, you know, we need new blood. And maybe he's saying the Democrats need new blood. And, of course, Gomez is a Republican, but he is young.
Well, you know, that the first – did I say this on the air yesterday with you off the air? The first commercial, if it happens to be Markey against Gomez, and we have no idea, is going to be an unattractive picture of Ed Markey saying 36 years in Washington, and then a picture of Gabriel Gomez in the Navy SEALs saying 0 years in Washington. That's what the issue is going to end up becoming. 877-301-8970. Anything else during your voting that aggravated you today, Emily, or no? I'm serious. You have all the time you want.
I never know my little precinct. I get dull. So I was in the wrong line once, but that was my fault.
You know the great line from Jack Parr, quote, every election day, remember the first one, host of the Tonight Show, I never vote. It only encourages them, which I think is really a wonderful line. Let's go to Russ, who's in a car, who apparently isn't voting either. Hey, Russ.
Hey, guys. Hi. I called in a few weeks ago when you had one of the Republican candidates on your show,
yep.
and I said I would vote for Republicans if Republicans really did stay out of people's business. You know, I believe in the Second Amendment, but I also believe in a woman's right to choose. And I'd vote for you if you told me that you were not going to take away the right of the people you disagree with. And his answer was, well, Russ, I'm going to go down to Washington and roll up my sleeves and do the hard work and blah, 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 blah. And he didn't answer the question. So I don't really know what any of these candidates stand for. I'd rather not vote for two old white men, but it would be nice to know that there were candidates out there with strong convictions on issues that matter. And I don't feel that anyone on either side has those. So I'm really not very enthusiastic about this election in general.
Well, let's do
that's
a public.
Why I'm probably not going to vote.
Let's do a public service here. Correct me if I'm wrong. Sullivan is pro-life. The other two Republicans are pro-choice. Correct?
Well, I know Dan Winslow is. I don't know if Gomez is a little more nuanced. I'm not quite sure.
I think he's pro-choice as well, but he's certainly not a pro-life. We know that much.
Russ, thank you for your call. I mean, part of the problem, you said this to me this morning, we are part of the problem, I don't mean just you and me, is, you know, the conventional wisdom that knows, well, the marathon caused them to go dark for a week. There was a real problem pre-marathon as well. And, you know, did we do the job? We had everybody in here, and I'm sure you did too, Emily. I mean, did we do enough on this special election so that people did know what
their positions
were?
There were a lot of distractions. There was a big blizzard in February. There was Menino announcing he wasn't going to run in March. Then the marathon came.
When was John Keller's – was John Keller's debate the night after the marathon, the final Democratic debate? Or was it the night of the marathon? Is that possible?
No. It was Tuesday.
Yeah.
It was Tuesday. Okay.
And but it wasn't a week after? Wasn't it last Tuesday?
Maybe it was. You might have
been
right.
So it was a week and a day after.
Well, one of the interesting things, I talked to a number of voters today, and one of the things they said, even those, as we're saying, those who have a stake in this race and they're educated, whatever, everybody that I asked, did you watch the debates, to a person, they said no. No, I didn't watch any of the debates. I read up on the candidates a little bit. I heard a little bit of the sound bites. I heard a little bit of the coverage. But nobody said that they watched the debates.
You know, they used to teach civics in school. Maybe we need to have civics being
apparently
taught.
We missed
in
a great
again.
Debate last night in South Carolina with Sanford and
Colbert.
Oh,
and
Colbert.
Oh,
yes.
And by,
oh,
it's
I
Colbert,
would have loved
the way
that.
She pronounces
Colbert
Stephen
Bush.
Colbert's sister.
Yeah.
But she apparently raised the issue of how can you deal with fiscal responsibility from Sanford when you're off to another country on taxpayer dollars.
Spending our money in
firecracker.
Argentina.
But you hear what his response was?
He said, what?
Someone said to him, someone said, do you regret having voted to impeach Bill Clinton? And he went on to say, I think in defense to what Colbert's sister had broached, about do you never forgive a person for the rest of their life for their sins, which is not horrible answer. That's fine. Says Evelyn.
she's doing better than expected against him.
I think she's leading in that.
Yeah.
She's
didn't
he hold
anyway, it was a great debate, apparently.
Oh.
Yeah, well. We need a little sex appeal in our debates
We do. Stephen Colbert is the moderator.
That's why when we had Scott Brown
absolutely
made it more colorful.
He made it very much more colorful. That's absolutely true. Well, the matinee idol. I mean, no one can get over the matinee idol factor with Scott
Brown.
And,
you know,
Brown.
The Pocahontas thing. You know, he was big on that. You know, he was.
Now, one thing I got to say, I mean, in fairness, and we're talking about turnout here, and turnout's obviously low, but this is a primary for a special election for a single Senate seat. So, you know, you can't get too discouraged. And one of the things that's encouraging when I'm talking to all these poll workers at all these various places is, you know, the last time we had an election was a presidential election. We had a close Senate race again. And so they had turnout that was off the charts last time around. So it says something. I think it says something about us and how much emphasis we sort of tend to put on bigger marquee national races, national government. That sort of dominates the conversation. But when it comes to a more local level, I think people are less engaged. And I'm not sure what that says about us as citizens. But it's worth noting because the last time we had an election here, we had great turnout.
Now, we have to correct what Marjorie and I both said about Gabriel Gomez. He describes himself as pro-life, but I think the place where this is defending our incorrect information, he says he does not believe Roe v. Wade should be overturned. So it's one of the, I mean, I guess you could say
that's
it's sort
nuanced.
Of
a, you said
Ted,
it right.
Well, but I mean,
you
Ted
can't
Kennedy.
Be pro-life if you say, you can be, you, it, what he should say is he's personally pro-life because you can't be
like
pro-life.
A lot of Catholic liberals.
I'm against it. It's got to be legal. That's what I always say.
Joe Biden has said the same thing. He's personally
like
pro-life,
it. It's
but
legal.
He's exactly. He's professionally pro-choice.
Right.
Well, I think even Mario Cuomo took that. Didn't
Mario Cuomo
not
took the
take
exact same stand.
Yeah, a lot of
Kennedy
Catholic
took
Democrats
the exact
there.
Same stand.
Let's go to Natick, where Marge is on the phone on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Marge.
Hey, thanks, Jim and Marjorie. I really like your show. Thanks. I just want to say that I really think the print media, at least, has a lot to do with this. When you go looking for information about candidates, you're much more likely to find stuff about Kim Kardashian than you are about the stance of any one candidate on any of the issues.
By the way, I voted for Kim Kardashian in the primary this morning.
Marge, in defense of,
I totally disagree.
In defense
with
of the print media, they're the only ones, that do the detailed coverage of politics. It's television that ignores
those endless profiles that the Globe did. How many of those did you read, Marge?
It's very hard. Let's just lump all the media in then and just say it's very hard to find information on candidates and their positions. And also, I was looking, I think it was yesterday or the day before, at either the New York Times or the Washington Post. And you know they have that line on top where they have sort of the most popular or important, it's like a menu where you click on what's going on.
Yeah.
And Gwyneth Paltrow's dress is at the same level as, you know, the bombers. I mean, it's all one
most
thing.
Emailed.
Yeah. Or most viewed, or most something.
It's all, it's all presented at a single level.
You know, Marge, let me echo what, if I may interrupt you, and echo what Emily and Marjorie said. I think the print media has done a great job, too. The problem is it's all been backburnered, even if it was on the front page, by our obsession, understandably, not only with the marathon for the last couple of weeks. Prior to that, the gun control debate was reaching a crescendo, and there was a huge talk about that. The impact of the sequester, it just has come at a time when there are a huge number of big state and national stories. But Marge, so Marge, are you voting or not voting? You didn't tell us.
Voting.
You are voting.
But very hard to find me. I'm still not sure that I'm doing the right thing.
Well, you have 7.5 hours to figure it out. Marge, thank you.
Thank you.
Very much. 8 o'clock. We should have said that the polls are open at 8 o'clock if you non-voters want to atone for your at least early decision.
I hear what Marge is saying, but I have to say, you know, We live in an information age where more information is available to voters than has ever been ever before. Not only just what's in the print media, and you have big newspapers who are online, and even, you know, you can find articles, but there are, you know, bloggers. There are people who cover this stuff in detail. There are 501c3 organizations that can give you the voting record of all of these people. Yeah. I mean, on the Democratic side, we have two people who have been in Congress. We can do the work ourselves and find that out. It's all available
to
us if we want to do the work.
Their websites. I mean, they do have.
Yeah, how'd you find that?
They're going to have their basic positions on their websites.
That's right.
Well, I should have known it, actually. I did Google it. Let's go to Norwell where Dave's on the phone. Dave, you not vote? Oh, you did vote. Dave, who'd you vote for and why?
I voted for Gabriel Gomez.
Why?
Because he's a non-politician, but he's not an incumbent. I'm so sick of the do-nothing Congress down there. I have even less of an opinion of him than the general country has.
Do you care what Gomez stands for? Wait. Do you care what he stands for, good or bad? Or your major concern was you wanted a fresh face with no Washington connections?
I want a fresh face.
Yeah, Dave, thanks for the call. A lot of people are going to be critical today. I think that's it's going to be a very popular position, should Gomez win the primary today, against one guy who served Lynch has been in state and federal government for a couple of decades, and
that's
Markey
right.
has been in Washington for 36.
36. Jim doesn't like term limits.
I don't.
That's part of the problem.
I don't like term limits. You support term limits?
No, we have term limits.
Say what they are. Yeah. They'll aggravate Marjorie. Say it. Go ahead.
Election day is the term limit. But the problem is, especially in Massachusetts, where the legislature is so heavily Democratic, it is almost impossible to beat these incumbents. It's just impossible. Wouldn't we have a more fair government in Massachusetts, less corruption, if we had more Republicans? Emily Rooney.
You talk at the state level as opposed to the national offices?
Yes.
I don't know. I don't know why anybody would want to do it. So.
Neither do I. I don't know why anybody would want to do it either, to take all the abuse that we get.
Let's close it out with
Richard,
somebody who actually voted.
From Milton. You voted. Good for you.
Yes, I voted.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say two things. Number one, I can't understand. I don't know where they stand for. All you got to do is watch television. And, for example, you know that Markey stands for the rights of women, for health care reform. And you know that Gabriel Gomez can recite the second half of the Pledge of Allegiance.
That's a good line.
Oh my goodness.
The second thing I want to say is we have to be the whiniest country in the world. In countries where Taliban cuts your hand off if they found out you voted, and we're complaining, oh, he gave me the wrong ballot. That's why I don't vote. For God's sake, get over it.
I love you, Richard.
We're the best country in the world for free voting, and everybody's whining and finding an excuse other than their own laziness. Why not to vote?
Good for you, Richard. Thank you so much for your call. I am 100% with Richard from Milton. So Emily has voted. Edgar has voted. I have voted. The pressure would be on you, Marjorie Egan.
I'm there.
To fulfill your Democratic
pledge.
I'm
going to be over to my little polling place.
Do your civic duty, Marjorie.
And I don't have to have my license this time. They told me I don't have to identify myself after they requested that I do.
Last time they did.
They asked me for my driver's license.
They turned her away.
I heard a story. They told me.
Yeah, they did. But then they realized I was a reporter and they chased me out of the parking lot.
Yep.
Okay.
Emily and Edgar, thanks.
Talking about Election Day with Emily Rooney and Edgar B. Herwick III. The polls do close at 8 o'clock, so you have plenty of time to do your civic duty. Duty. Oops. Okay, we all learned the rule was too big to fail. It did not apply to our banking system. Well, could the same be said for our intelligence agencies? Up next, since 9/11, our top secret agencies have ballooned. But are they doing a better job? That conversation on Boston Public Radio coming up.
Immigrants in Chicago work for some major American companies indirectly, you might say, via a whole bunch of middlemen.
I think they're trying to create a level of deniability that if there's a problem with the pay, that it's not their problem, it's the Reitero's problem.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, a special investigation with ProPublica, labor brokers and minimum wage workers, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Mass Eye and Ear, offering specialty services at more than a dozen locations in the Boston area, and now a new center in the Longwood Medical Area. Visit masseyeandear.org for more information. And Gentle Giant Moving Company, with more than 30 years of experience and 15 locations throughout New England, New York, and Washington, D.C., offering local, long-distance, and international moving services. GentleGiant.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan.
It started out 11 people in the old executive office building, but that wasn't big enough. So they moved to some of the priciest real estate in the Washington area. And now they are gigantic, 500,000 square feet, 5 Walmarts stacked on top of each other. And if you ask most people in the intelligence world, they don't know exactly what they do still.
You just heard a piece of Frontline's Top Secret America, 9/11 to the Boston Bombings. In part, it explores the question of whether the huge Top Secret America infrastructure could have and should have prevented the Marathon bombings. Joining us on the line is Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The Washington Post. You can catch her tonight on that Frontline. It airs on PBS at 10. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, Dana Priest.
Good to be here, Jim.
Hi, Dana. It's Marjorie Egan here. So, Dana, what do you conclude about the Boston Marathon? Would there have been a way to prevent it or not?
I don't think we know yet, but what we do know is that all the pieces didn't come together, and the question is, had they, would it have made a difference? But to back up, they should have. You know, after so many other near misses, each time the agencies involved in counterterrorism have come together and said, okay, we made a mistake, we'll do better. And they've by now put the national counterterrorism at the center of all this. It's supposed to receive information from the CIA, the FBI, the other agencies. And so far, I know that it did receive a cable from the CIA alerting them to their Russian tip-off that the older brother had gone to Russia and that the Russians were concerned. But we don't know yet whether the FBI's data would have made it to the analysts within the NCTC, who are really the specialists on Chechnya. At the NCTC, they have specialists in every type of terrorist organization and in every part of the world. And it's there that you would expect even the slightest tips to be best analyzed and followed through on.
Well, Donna, you know what I wonder, and you obviously are an expert at this, and Top Secret America explores all this, but just as a newcomer to this after the marathon, it struck me that there's no buck stops here. You know, you've got the terrorism experts you just mentioned, you've got the FBI, you've got the CIA. Is there like a buck stops here or not?
That was the question that came up after the underwear bomber, the Nigerian, who tried to blow up a plane. That's the question they asked at that time. And the answer was, according to the director of national intelligence at the time, there was no place where the buck stopped. And so he was going to create it. He created what's called the pursuit teams. And they reside within the National Counterterrorism Center, that center that's described in the opening as 500,000 square feet. So the question is, what did they know and what did they do with what they knew? The other thing I really have to point out is that Janet Napolitano, the DHS secretary, has said, well, the case file was closed on him when the FBI looked at the Russian information, interviewed some people, didn't find anything. These days, no case file ever gets closed. That's the whole point of having these databases, because if someone creates a file on someone else, even if nothing derogatory, nothing that suspicious exists on that person at the time, the file sits in these databases just in case there's another scrap of information that comes in and another one. And pretty soon, there's a picture that starts to worry somebody. That's the whole point of these databases.
You know, Donna Priest, I'm so glad you said that, because as you're speaking, I'm saying to myself, if I didn't pay a MasterCard bill in 1987 and had made every payment in the intervening 25 years. But, you know, you mentioned Janet Napolitano and the expiration of the watch or whatever it was called. Janet Napolitano gave one answer, the head of Homeland Security, to whether or not they knew that the older brother had gone to Russia for 6 months, and another agency, the FBI or someone, gave another answer. And then we find out that the expiration, talk about frightening, happened during the 6 months that he was out of the country. So people knew he had left the country, knew about the 2011 interview with the FBI, in which they concluded, apparently, that there's no great threat. And this thing expired. It seems to me, even if you hadn't said what you just said, that is the flimsiest, most pathetic kind of excuse for not being on top of this.
It could be that in someone's system, things expire after a given period of time. That's part of the issue, is that every one of these agencies, and we found 1,200 of them that now work on counterterrorism at the top secret level, every one of them has a different way of dealing with things. And expired could mean one thing with someone else, but like I was saying, you know, it should mean other things with especially the FBI, who's charged with domestic terrorism. They have a whole database called the Guardian database, in which suspicions, the slightest suspicions, are live there until they can be improved upon, or they just sit there until eternity, until nothing else happens. And you want the people with the best knowledge of Chechnya, with the best knowledge of Russia, to be able to look at all these scraps when it comes to him. And the question we don't know yet is whether that was done.
Dana Priest, let me ask a stupid question before Marjorie asks the stupid question.
A lot of stupid questions here, 1,200
Jim. Agencies, is that what you just said, that have in some ways overlapping jurisdiction?
Well, that's right. 1,200 that work at the top secret level. If we went to the secret level, there'd be many more than that, which was why we couldn't hope to even follow it. I mean, these include things in the Army, in the CIA, and every intelligence agencies, plus all the federal departments, and we're not even talking about state and local. You know, the Boston Joint Terrorism Task Force, there are about 120 task forces in the country, the JTTFs they call them. They bring together, depending on where they are, a dozen to two dozen different agencies themselves. So in this case, we have a Border Patrol agent who was given information that the older brother came back in the country. And there's a question what he did with that. Well, his job sitting at the JTTF is to tell everybody there so that they can, you know, do something. It might not be a big something, but the JTTFs should have, and I know they do have, They have informants who are members of mosques. They have informants in neighborhoods of ethnic groups. What did they do with that information in order to make sure that it wasn't something of interest?
We're talking with Dana Priest. She works for the Washington Post, and she's got this documentary on PBS tonight at 10 o'clock on Frontline, Top Secret America. So I guess you've got all these amazing statistics, you know, that, you know, 854 people have these top secret security clearances, and there's all these thousands of agencies coordinating all this stuff. We've been hearing all about stovepiping in the wake of the marathon bombings, Dana. So is that what you keep talking about here with the sharing information, that the stovepiping occurred again?
You know, it looks like it. We don't have the full story. Again, it's not supposed to be there. Again, you have the center of the universe now is supposed to be the National Counterterrorism Center. And the question is, you know, did one of those organizations that had a scrap? Nobody had enough to go on that would have, you know, really alerted this, that this person was a problem. But did it go altogether to the person who really would be able to evaluate that? And it doesn't look like it did. There are, as you said, there are more than 800,000 people with top secret clearances. And part of the problem with that is that there's still a reticence sometimes to share classified information between individuals and different agencies. That's something they have worked on very hard. It's gotten a lot better in some places, and in other places, it's just still not.
Dana Priest, when you talk to the people at the top of these pyramids or this infrastructure, does it gall them that the Times Square bomber ultimately detected because of the work of a private citizen? You mentioned this in your documentary tonight. Obviously, the Tsarnaevs were, at least the younger brother when he survived, was because of the diligence of a homeowner in Watertown who checked out his boat because he was upset that the tarp or the shrink wrap.
And the shoe bomber. The shoe bomber, too.
Right. Does that drive them nuts or no?
Oh, I think that they're grateful that that happened, because if it hadn't, you know, and he was still on the run, they would mm-hmm. be so much more roundly criticized. And I also have to say, we're not going to ever create in the United States a foolproof system unless, you know, we become a country that we're not, in which case, you know, everybody gets surveilled and we have a Gestapo-like police. So there's always going to be things that slip through. The question is, if we paid this much money for this, if we spent this much time and effort to make this a good system, where are the problems? And it just seems as if this is another case where we can identify issues that shouldn't exist at this time and that should be ironed out, so that the next time it happens, you know, we won't be looking, or we won't find that the information didn't come together.
Is it fair to say, Dana Priest, that if what had happened in Boston, I know this is a hypothetical, were planned by Al-Qaeda, as opposed to, at least based on what we know now, a small-scale plot for two brothers in East Cambridge who'd done some traveling and some internet surfing, that if it had been the former rather than the latter, the likelihood of top secret America having prevented this would have been greater?
I would think so, because by its nature, the network has to pass information from person to person, and we're very focused on Al-Qaeda. It is these lone bombers that would be the most difficult to understand, most difficult to identify and to stop. And that is the instance where I don't think you're never going to get to foolproof, but you should, you know, at least have your institutions working correctly and your information being shared so that that doesn't happen. You know, the other issue here is, I hate to say it because it's technology, but all these different organizations still have a technological problem. They, like your credit card, your credit score is a great example. How is it that if you didn't pay some tiny bill back when you were a student, it is going to make it into your credit system? Well, the government still doesn't have a way to talk to each other, the different systems like the credit bureau and that sort of thing.
Should we make the head of Visa head of the CIA?
Exactly.
Is that what we should do?
Well, at least the head of the Department of Homeland Security, so we can get Get the information flowing.
Well, Donna, I don't want to get too depressed here. We have, I've read this elsewhere, and you talk about it as well on Frontline Tonight. I mean, we have not had a catastrophic 9/11, like massive, disastrous terrorist attack, obviously, since 9/11. So we have gotten better at that, haven't we?
Absolutely. And I'm not saying that if they had known everything, it would have mattered. All I'm saying is we think we know now that, you know, one group of people wasn't given everything to look at. So even if they had, it's still very possible that he wouldn't have raised enough of a flag for them to have done what they could have done to stop him. That is still very likely. And again, that brings us back to the, you know, the lone wolf type of person. And on the good side, on the positive side, if you look at how the bin Laden operation was pursued with a very skilled, experienced group of analysts and operators who were so focused on one target. That is how things work well, is when you have people who are experienced in a subject working together to pursue that subject. What doesn't seem to still work is when you have a vast network of people who are not experts trying to comb the waterfront for clues. That just doesn't seem to be the right way to go about it.
Dana Priest, let's spend a few minutes, if you can, on the future. And by the way, we're talking to Dana Priest, who you will see tonight at 10 o'clock on PBS with Frontline's Top Secret America, 9/11 to the Boston bombings. Divided into two parts, what the intelligence community is going to do out of this and then what Congress is going to do. In terms of the intelligence community, because of the scale of this, you've mentioned the lone wolves thing a couple of times. Does that mean that more surveillance, video or other kinds, are in our future? Is that likely? Is that what the intelligence heads are going to recommend?
I think that because of your second part, Congress, they're probably going to end up recommending something. And that's a political decision and a political answer, because Congress will find somebody at fault. They have to blame somebody. So I think you'll get some of that. But depending on what we find, the intelligence world might not reorganize itself or add to itself. It will just figure out a way, hopefully, to make sure all information gets to the right person. And, you know, I would think that some people might be criticized internally in their organizations if they didn't pass on a piece of information. But you can't expect a 100% foolproof system. And I think that if our Congress wants to be honest about terrorism at all the different varieties that there are, they will have to make that point to people. We've done a good job making sure that people don't get into the country who want to do us harm. We've done a good job in destroying Al-Qaeda and overseas and knowing where other groups that are affiliated with it are in the world. You know, we've done an excellent job in that regard. It's much more problematic here because of our civil liberties and because there are still a lot of organizations that I don't think have an added value in this. And hopefully, instead of just adding more, they will winnow them down to the experts who will work together and who know how to handle scraps of information and create databases that can talk to each other and add two and two together.
Dana Priest, last question for me. I mentioned the congressional thing you did too. Yesterday in studio, we had this guy, Joe Whipple, who worked for the CIA for 30 years. He was their congressional relations person. You obviously know him for a year. And when we asked him, Marjorie, I can't remember. So can Congress actually, like grown-ups, have a hearing on this that doesn't devolve into something a la Benghazi with partisan? He smiled at us with a slight laugh. Does Congress have the ability post Marathon Monday to have a hearing on the content of this that doesn't just fall into this, it happened on Obama's watch from the Republicans and the Democrats say we did everything right?
I don't think so. Unless they've, you know, changed their stripes overnight. Congress has been a problem in this. Congress demands 100% perfection and doesn't understand, I believe, the, you know, nuances in intelligence. And people do still score points, political points. And more than that, they haven't pushed the administration. No Congress has pushed an administration to really speak honestly to the American people about what they know, about what they don't know. And so we all still have very high expectations that nothing will ever happen. And I think this is a good one of the lessons that could come out of this is to understand the limits of how things, what systems can do. But first, we have to make sure that they were working as they should have worked. And I think that's the number one step. And then after that, we can have that larger discussion about how safe we are, what is the landscape now on terrorism, and what can really be done about lone wolves, which I do think is fairly limited unless they want to change more laws.
And I suppose on a much more mundane level, we might be able to solve the national deficit problems if we get a handle on how much all this redundancy and overlapping is costing us. We don't know that, do we, Dana? We have no idea. A lot.
Well, a lot, and much more than it did, obviously, before 9/11. But no, we don't know much about that because it's classified.
Dana Priest, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it. And a great documentary tonight.
Thank you so much.
Dana Priest is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The Washington Post. And as Jim said before, you can catch her tonight on PBS at 10 o'clock on Frontline in the fantastic documentary Top Secret America, 9/11 to the Boston Bombings. Okay, we're going to open up our lines at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. Are you concerned that these huge, intricate, intelligence agencies can't keep track of people? But as you just heard Jim and Dana Priest say, your credit card company can. And so can your library, and so can your gym. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. I found that whole thing extremely depressing. I mean, you know, the waste, the redundancy, the overlapping, the fact that there's absolutely no buck stopping here, even though they did create these pursuit groups, but the pursuit groups don't seem to be taking you know, the responsibility either. This is really...
Bring it back down to the barbershop level. Hello, the first thing you said is true. A credit card, you're not the kind of person who would ever order your credit report. You ever order your credit report?
No, I just know when you go for your mortgage, they tell you what your credit report is.
If you order your credit report, you will find charges and late payments and credit cards you don't even remember you had. They stay there forever. But if you do something that alerts an intelligence agency to your behavior, even if they decide you're perfectly fine, that disappears. I mean, that to me was the most stunning thing she had to say.
If you do apply for a mortgage, and they say, you know, back in 1992, you were a week late with your payment to Filene's Basement, which of course isn't even in business anymore. Why were you late? And then they want to tell you to make up some excuse about why you were late for your payment. That's a very good point.
I'm not going to mention this person's name because I don't think he wants me to.
Oh, please do.
He's a friend of yours too. He was telling me yesterday about how he applied. He paid off his mortgage a decade or so ago.
He did.
He's applying for a second mortgage. He goes to the bank to get it, and they say, well, there's an $80,000 lien on your house. And he said, well, that's not possible. That was the original mortgage. We paid the whole mortgage. Well, all you have to do, sir, is go back to the bank and you know, get the it was clear that essentially it was paid. Well, the bank was Shawmut Bank. Do you remember what happened to Shawmut Bank?
They were shut down.
They were shut down. And the successor, Fleet, that bought it, that was shut down too. But the interesting part was, they had records back 20-plus years on whether or not – he ultimately cleared it – on whether or not he had paid his mortgage. But after a certain period of time, Tamerlan Tsarnaev's name disappears from some watch list while he's in run. You know, by the way, if it wasn't for the fact that there are four dead people, counting Sean Collier, obviously, the MIT police officer, Richard Donahue is still lying in a hospital, 260 people injured. This would be like a Keystone Cops funny kind of thing. But it makes the comparison to make it real for yourselves at 877-301-8970. Your credit card company does a better job of tracking all your transactions than the United States intelligence infrastructure does. It is, sir, real. Let's take some calls.
Let's go to Eric in Amherst. Thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. Hi, Eric.
Hello, Eric.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Well, I don't think you've invited the person that you should be interviewing instead of Dana Priest.
Who should we be interviewing?
You should be interviewing Sibel Edmonds.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
She was former FBI linguist and did a lot of work on translations right after that event in late summer of 2001.
Yeah.
So Google Sybil Edmonds. And
well, just tell us on. Just tell us what she's going to say that we missed.
Well, she's going to tell you exactly what happened, you know, in all these events over the last 12 years and why, and that the Boston event was actually, it's all a cover-up. There's no, these kids were not directly involved in the bombing, and she'll explain why.
Well, I have to say, Eric, you can send us an email at bpr@wgbh.org. I have to say, with that comment, my sense is we're not going to be having her on anytime soon, yeah. But thank you so much for your contribution. 877-301-8970. You know, it sounded a little bit like Sarnaev's mother, and it was all a Hollywood movie kind of thing.
And she said there was paint on the street.
Paint,
instead
not blood.
Of blood on the street.
Let's get back to the subject at hand. We just talked to Dana Priest, who I think actually knows a hell of a lot about what she is commenting on. And tonight at 10 o'clock, you can see this Top Secret America, this documentary from 9/11 to the Boston bombings. And it is just, you keep saying to me this on and off the air. I am incredulous about how the simplest kinds of record keeping and information sharing. I don't care about these turf battles. As you said, where does the buck stop? Why is there not one person who has the ability or one agency that has the ability to basically order everybody with the power of the president behind him or her?
Well, who wants to have their neck stuck out like that? Nobody does. They just assume be able to say, well, you know, the CIA was supposed to do it, or well, you know, the FBI was supposed to do it.
1,200 top secret agencies. 1,200 in the United States government.
Well, the other thing that we didn't get to, there's a big political problem here, too, because the moment someone says, well, we cut back on the CIA's counterterrorism unit or something, and then something happens, and then that politician that voted to cut back on the CIA's money is hung out to dry. So,
well, that happened with the GOP and the Benghazi thing and the request for additional security. Our number is 877-301-8970. Are you as troubled as I am? Maybe you're not. That credit card companies do a better job tracking your history than apparently the U.S. intelligence infrastructure does.
Let's go to Lisa in Boston. Thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. Lisa, hi.
Hey, you guys. I miss you.
Well, we're back. Yeah.
I know. Thank God. But I'm never in the car at 12. So let me just say this really quick.
Sure.
Because I have to be somewhere. I can't get over how they knew that the government was so incompetent. Well, let's call a spade. If you were being watched at some point in 2011 by Homeland Security and the FBI, think of how brazen they were thinking that we were competent. They were still being watched. He was leaving the country, coming back, and blowing up people.
Yeah.
How mortified are you over that?
You know, Lisa,
he's smarter than we are.
Lisa, it took me 16 days. At about 11 o'clock this morning, I turned to Marjorie and said, you know what I never thought of before? And it was exactly the point you were making. They obviously he knew he was the subject of an interview. Tamerlan was, and I assume his brother was told just 2 short years ago. And you're right; they either knew how inept
the infrastructure
was. What's
they
that?
Were running in and out. They were being careful. They were thinking they were being watched, and they were going, "Oh my God, they didn't catch us today! They didn't catch us today!"
Or maybe they weren't brazen at all. Maybe they're just stupid. And I think considering what happened after they planted these bombs on Monday, and the fact they were still around. And their behavior on Thursday night suggests that maybe it isn't brazenness, but stupidity. Lisa, we're glad to hear from you again. Thanks so much.
Well, that is one of the great unanswered questions in this mystery, and I hope we do get this answer, is did they have some plan to cover their tracks? I mean, it was incredible, as everyone has reported, that the younger brother's right back down at UMass Dartmouth. He's going to the gym. He's tweeting. He's a stress-free kind of guy.
Well, isn't that the answer to your question? The answer is no. I mean, they had no plan. They had no plan for the future, except maybe Thursday night they hatched one to go to New York. We don't know if that's true or not.
And the other fact that's so bizarre is that even if you're not the brightest guy in the world, you would think that there'd be a lot of people at the marathon finish line photographing their friends and family finishing the race, and not to think you might be seen was quite incredible, too.
I know.
Let's go to Jeff from Hyannis. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Great show,
Thanks.
As always.
Thanks.
I think there was a book written about the main problem a while ago. It was called Data Smog.
Mm-hmm.
It means when you get
you mean too much.
Too much.
Just too much, too big, they can't handle it. Is that where you're going?
Yes, exactly. And just like the credit cards, which was a great example, they actually use artificial intelligence, so they don't know at the end of the day how it works. But you get the false negatives when they stop my mother from buying her groceries after 20 years. And you get the false positives. And you also get the false negatives, which means you don't know that they're there. So I think, especially as you mentioned, for good reason, the lone wolf syndrome, they're not going to be able to cover it. And I think the second important issue, and then a bit off the line, is no matter what the computer results are, you have what I call the gray matter problem, which means you need to have a person review it. And those people are fallible also. So I really don't think there's going to be an answer better than what we have currently.
Jeff, thanks for your call.
Listen to these are just a couple of statistics from this Top Secret America documentary that's on tonight at 10 o'clock on Channel 2. Some 1,271 government organizations and 1,931 private companies work on programs related to terrorism at 10,000 different locations across the United States of America. I mean,
how do you oversee all this?
It's
how do you
massive.
Coordinate all this?
50,000 intelligence reports are produced every year, but we're not really sure who reads them or if they're read at all.
No. Well, that was the gray matter thing that the caller was just saying
exactly.
A minute ago. Let's squeeze in another one. Let's go to Richard. You're in Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hello, Richard.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I just want to comment on the whole how this is all going on. The government's trying to pass the CISPA thing, so they want to get information. CISPA, they're trying to get more information. So it's basically to protect Facebook or Google from releasing users' information to the government.
Thing.
So while this is all going on, they're trying to get this passed, but like you were saying earlier, they can't keep track of people. They can't keep track of anyone's information, but they're still trying to go and grab more information from people.
Well, they're too busy collecting the information to have time to use the information, Richard.
I guess
Thank you for thanks for your call.
I thought you had the best idea, Jim.
What's that?
Put the guy that runs Visa in charge of this whole thing.
No, really? They track everything I have ever done.
They don't miss a dime.
By the way, CISPA is the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. Thank you to our colleagues for filling out the acronym for us.
Okay, up next, it's time for Open Mic with Charlie Baker. We're going to talk a little bit of politics, I think, with him. Stay tuned for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Immigration reform, gun control, sequestration, job creation. There's been a lot on President Obama's agenda in the first 100 days of his second term. How's he handling it all? Guests from both political parties assess the president's batting average on the issues. Next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Gardner Mattress, specializing in handmade, lace-tufted, and custom-made mattresses. Handcrafted wood bed frames on display also. Celebrating 80 years, located in Salem, Woburn, and Newton. GardnerMattress.com. And Frontline. In the wake of the Marathon bombings, Americans are wondering, have counterterrorism efforts made us any safer? Don't miss Top Secret America, 9/11 to the Boston bombings. Tuesday at 10 on WGBH2.
This is Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan joining us as he does every Tuesday. Is today Tuesday? Yes, every Tuesday.
Not lately Tuesday.
Well, we missed one on Open Mic. There is that voice. He's the former Republican candidate for governor, former head of Harvard Pilgrim. Hey, Charlie Baker.
Hey, guys. Can we just for a second stick to this topic you were talking about before?
Sure.
Sure.
You know, having been in both the public and private sector, I'm well aware of this data issue, and I can boil it down pretty simply, which is that. You know, when I got to Harvard Pilgrim some 10 years ago, we had three different databases in which we carried information on our members, and they were all legacy systems, which means they didn't talk to each other, and they were all set up to do different things, right? One of them was supposed to help with enrollment, one was supposed to help with customer service, one was supposed to help with sort of managing the relationship with the provider network, and you couldn't get a single view of anybody. And one of the first things I said when I got there was, you know, how can we possibly do a good job representing ourselves to our members if we can't actually see the relationship we have with our members in a holistic way? And so one of the things we did was we went to one database where one identifying, one, you know, member identification number, so so that we would be collecting on one file every interaction we had with people so that we could do a good job of servicing them and representing their interests. Private organizations do that. That's the way they come at that. That's the way they think about it. But public organizations, and in many cases, a lot of the ones you're talking about in law enforcement and security and all the rest, not only do they not share information, in many cases they have statutes in place that tell them, you know, under no circumstances are they ever supposed to share information with anybody. And I used to, when I was at Health and Human Services, I ran into this all the time, where it used to frustrate me that I couldn't get a single look at somebody's, and this is just Health and Human Services, that I couldn't get a single look at a family's relationship with Health and Human Services. And I used to say, how are we supposed to do a good job of serving this family and representing their interests and the interests of the taxpayers and everybody else if we can't come up with a single way of seeing how we connect with this family and how what we do serves them? And you take that, you multiply it by all those federal and state and local agencies, my God.
Well, you've been in the business sector and the private and obviously the public sector. And in light of the fact that we're not going to privatize the intelligence infrastructure of America, does your experience in both areas suggest to you this is hopeless on the federal level?
I don't think it's hopeless, but I think it's a much, much bigger challenge than I think some people realize. And that's not an excuse, okay? But it's a brawl, and it's a brawl that has sort of real issues mixed in with phony ones where people will just protect their turf and say that all their data has to be kept confidential. They can't share it with anybody else for reasons A, B, or C, all of which are primitive and stupid, but they'll fight to the death over them. And in some cases, people really don't want, you know, they don't want necessarily the IRS to be able to access all the information that that the Treasury has or that the armed forces have or that all the other or that the local folks have. And I don't think that's...
Charlie...
I guess all I'm saying is I think I understand why this is such a big problem. And when you then put it in the context of a lot of systems that were built over the course of, you know, 30 or 40 years using really old technology to write all the code and all the rest, and none of it talks to anybody else, and
We're talking to Charlie Baker. Charlie, the whole privacy thing, of course, was a big issue continuing post the bombings because, you know, Governor Deval Patrick and some state legislators are citing privacy issues when it comes to releasing the information about the degree to which taxpayers and when taxpayers were financing the nefarious deeds, possibly, of the two Tsarnaev brothers. And it's kind of incredible that we're worried about protecting the privacy of someone who's, in the older brother's case, dead.
No, if you commit the kind of crimes they've committed and you basically have confessed to committing those kinds of crimes, I think at some point, you know, there's a public interest issue that overrides this. And there is, frankly, a public interest issue exception associated with most of those privacy laws. And I certainly think it's been exceeded with regard to this one.
Hey, let's get back to local politics for a second. A special election today. You've said, correct me if I'm wrong, and I know you will, Charlie Baker, is when I've asked you 400 times if you're running for governor in the next election cycle, don't you say, isn't your answer, I got to first decide whether or not a Republican can win a statewide office in Massachusetts? Isn't that you? Don't you say that?
I have said that.
Okay, fine.
In the past, yes.
That's perfect. So can any of these three Republicans...
I'm glad to know you were listening. Jim.
I was. Some weeks I listened. Every word, Charlie. Whether it's Gomez, Winslow, or Sullivan, who emerges from the Republican primary by 8 o'clock tonight, answer the question for those three gentlemen. Can they win a Senate race against either Steve Lynch or Ed Markey in blue Massachusetts?
Well, I guess, obviously the simple truth is that's why we play the game. You know, you sort of never know what's going to happen in an election. It is a short cycle, which obviously means turnout matters more in some respects than some other things. And what the news cycle does can obviously affect this. That certainly had a lot to do with Scott Brown's race against Martha Coakley. But if you just look at the numbers today, I'm guessing maybe 150,000 people vote in the Republican primary, and I'm guessing something like 675,000 vote in the Democratic primary. That just tells you right there sort of that the that that the Republican has a much higher hill to climb than the Democrat does to win a race like
so that. So your answer is, I guess, more it's a long shot for whoever emerges. From
yeah, and
the
I think any of them would probably say it's a long shot, but it'd be pretty silly to say it's not doable given what happened in 2010.
Who'd you vote for?
I'm not going to tell you. It's a
how secret. How come your mentor, Bill Weld, endorsed Gabriel Gomez? And I assumed naively that that meant that your endorsement was going to follow. How come you didn't endorse?
Because I do everything that.
Exactly, whatever he tells you to do. Yeah. No, but wait a second.
I can't think for myself.
How come you didn't endorse? And I assumed, did all three of these candidates seek your endorsement?
All three of them are people that I've talked to at various points along the way. I know all three of them pretty well, and that's why I didn't endorse anybody. I'm a big fan. I'm from the Winslow camp, which says that any of us would be better than either of them on the other side.
So do you find, we've talked about this in the noon hour, the fact that the, I think one in five of us are showing up at the polls, which is not a big, huge number.
Which, what's really interesting
does it bother
about
you?
That, guys?
What?
It's also municipal election day.
Right.
I mean, there are other reasons for people to show up and vote today. I mean, all of your boards of selectmen, your city councils, your mayors, your school committee members, your town meeting members, those are all up today, too. It's a good day to get out, and it's a beautiful day to get out and vote.
How many votes do you get when you were elected to the whatever in Swampscott, by the way?
Selectmen.
1,200. I topped the ticket.
Hey, Charlie, can we go to a national issue for a second? We've talked to you a lot about taxes, and I met you discussing taxes several decades ago when you were writing me scathing letters for my positions on tax reform issues. The Grover Norquist, the sort of the guru of the no-tax pledge on the national level, he's actually a Massachusetts guy, is losing a lot of Republicans on this bipartisan, apparently imminent vote, a positive vote, to allow states to collect a sales tax on all online transactions, meaning even if there's no brick and mortar, as they say, even if there's no physical presence, if you order something from a company and you live in Swampscott, you got to pay the sales tax for Massachusetts. Where are you on that?
To tell you the truth, Jim, I think this one's more complicated than people are letting on.
Why?
Because there are 5,000 sales tax jurisdictions in the United States, and in many cases, the rules associated with this are complicated. And the reason the sales tax works so well for brick-and-mortar people is because you just collect the tax based on where you are. It's got nothing to do with where your customer's from.
Right.
So if I'm from New Hampshire and I'm shopping in Massachusetts, I just pay the sales tax because the person in Massachusetts charges me the sales tax because that's where they're located. When you get into these online guys, you're talking about people who have to actually figure out what the tax is, not based on where they are, but instead on where their customer is, which means they have to figure out all of the issues associated with all these taxing jurisdictions that exist everywhere. And I think it's a bigger and more complicated task than people are letting on at this point. And
but my understanding, let me just clarify for 1 second. My understanding is the legislation that's pending in Congress, in the Senate, it mandates that at least state jurisdictions, maybe not the lower level jurisdictions you're talking about, state jurisdictions have to provide free software to all these companies, these online companies over, I think it's over $1 million in revenue. They exempt the smallest retailers or service providers.
There was also a group that was put together almost 10 years ago to simplify all the issues associated between and among states with regard to sales tax differentials that never got anywhere or did anything. I'll tell you what, Jim, here's the deal. If we decide that the end game on this is to level the playing field between the brick-and-mortar folks and the online folks, which I certainly think is a legitimate concern, and say that what we'll do is we'll come up with a simple way to tax the online guys to sort of level the playing field on that, but the idea here won't be to raise a whole bunch of new revenue, so we'll reduce the rate overall. I'll be there with bells on.
So you'd support if it was a revenue neutral kind of deal, not to raise 370.
I think this is a land grab. I don't think it's about, I don't think for the most part it's about fairness, because no one's talking about doing anything about the rate. They're just talking about taxing another jurisdiction.
Hey, Marjorie has something she's obsessed with. She wants to ask you a quick question before you go, Charlie.
Oh, about my probation?
Yeah, I know you're obsessed with it. It's fine.
Well, I just want to ask you, for people that don't know, John O'Brien used to run the probation department. He just went through a state trial, accused essentially of giving unqualified people but who were politically connected jobs. Now he's facing 17 additional charges in a federal trial. But he's being accused of bribery. And he's being accused of bribing the heads of the Democratic Party here in Massachusetts, Charlie Baker. But the people that were allegedly receiving those bribes aren't getting charged. I find this incredibly confusing. What do you make of it?
I think this is a really tough case to prove, which has been borne out already in two different trials that we've all watched that have played out in state court. You know, how are you going to find a bribe here that involves multiple players and no obvious sort of, somebody gives somebody something and somebody gets something back.
Yeah.
And it doesn't involve a cash transaction at all. It involves these, you know, sort of trading for favors things. You know, quid pro quo is not exactly a foreign concept in politics. So I just think these are really hard cases to prove. And I think that's going to turn out to be the case on the federal level as well as on the state level.
But doesn't that mean, Charlie Baker, and you may be totally, well, obviously, look at Tim Cahill, the treasurer, look at the state trial. We now have a federal trial pending on John O'Brien, the probation guy, but obviously he was acquitted in the state trial. If it turns out they're that difficult, and it's evidenced by the acquittals, we'll see what happens at the federal level, it basically is saying that almost everything goes on Beacon Hill, and whether it's a Deval Patrick or a Charlie Baker who pledges in a campaign to change the culture on Beacon Hill, it seems to me it's impossible to change the culture if the laws don't provide you any infrastructure for changing the culture.
Yes and no. I mean, I think in some respects the impact of these cases and these trials all by itself has had an impact on the way people think about this stuff up there, and on what's considered to be appropriate behavior and what's considered to be not appropriate and legal and illegal. And I think in some respects, Jim, that people are far more sensitive to this stuff than they were before this all began.
I hope so.
Really?
No, I hope they're more cynical than me. No, I hope they are more sensitive because I think the probation department was left in a shambles, and it's a really important department. But Charlie Baker, thank you very much, as always, for being with us every Tuesday.
Hey, you guys have voted, right?
I'm going right this afternoon as soon as the show's over, Charlie.
I am wearing my I voted little sticker, Charlie Baker.
Awesome.
See you soon. Take care, Charlie.
That was Charlie Baker. We talk to him every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with the Globe's Brian McGrory. Okay, it's been over 2 weeks since the marathon bombings, and more than 250 people have been injured. 3 people were directly killed by the blast. Are advances in medicine the reason the death toll has been so remarkably low? That conversation with Dr. Michael Zinner, the chairman of the Department of Surgery at Brigham and Women's Hospital. That is up next on Boston Public Radio.
I'm James Edwards. I live here in Brighton, and I report here in Boston. Well, I do this because of the accountability.
The chamber's salary is far and away the highest in the state. And I would say that one of the reasons for that is that it is the largest, probably most complex urbanized environment in the state that has a city manager form of government.
Me sticking with journalism is sort of the work and kind of that sense of public good in a way. James Edwards, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Newbury Court, a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. Newbury Court in Concord, Massachusetts. You can schedule a visit any day of the week by visiting newburycourt.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3 is the chair of the Department of Surgery at Brigham and Women's Hospital. We've talked to him once before. He'll answer your questions and ours about how they saved all these lives, how the people are doing, and what the future of the most seriously injured holds. Dr. Michael Zinner, it's great to talk to you again. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Dr. Zinner, before we get to these medical questions, which absolutely fascinate me, just what is the latest at the Brigham? How many people are still there? How many people have been are no longer there and are off to rehabilitation?
So we had 35 come in the first day, and then 5 more come in after that in the next day. We admitted 19 of them. And about 12 of them went straight to the operating room. As of this morning, we were down to 6, and I suspect by this afternoon we'll be down to 4. Most of the discharges have been to rehab. A lot went to Spalding.
Okay. You know, we've all learned, and I've learned because I'm not a physician, that obviously the stopping the bleeding at the scene was crucial to the survival of many of these people that were hurt in the marathon. But when you get to the hospital, when they get to the Brigham,
What is it that you do? I know they were rushed into surgery to stop that bleeding. What do you do?
Well, if they in the field really had those tourniquets placed, then the population helped save their lives, whoever was doing that. It's one of those lessons learned from both the Iraq and Iranian – the Iraq and Afghanistan war. So we had about 23 people arrive within the first hour, which is a remarkable number. And within 12 minutes of the bombing, we had somebody show up at our door without really much warning. And then we placed a senior nurse and a physician at the door. And as patients began to roll in, we began to assign them to various stretchers in the emergency room. By that time, our staff had figured out what was going on and literally rushed to the emergency room. And it was pretty well orchestrated so that folks would arrive, they would be assigned a stretcher. And so between four and six physicians and nurses would be around each one of the victims as they came in. And they're basically assigned in priority. And
those triage.
Yes, ma'am. So at that point, the decision has to be made about which ones go straight to the operating room, which ones need to be resuscitated, can be held. I'll give you an example. There was there's a classic penetrating kind of wound that we always know have to go to the operating room. But the patient was very stable. And we didn't know what else was coming right after them. So with a stable patient, we kind of held that one back to see what else was coming in over the next hour. And then because they stayed stable, they ultimately got to the operating room. But it wasn't until later in the afternoon, in the early evening.
You know, we've read a lot about the training that the physicians throughout this medical infrastructure in Boston, or the whole medical, not just the doctors, nurses, and all the support structure. But it seems to me that that kind of training, again, not being in that field, is in the abstract. When all of a sudden there is something unlike that which any of your doctors and nurses have seen, unless they've served in war zones, does the training translate into reality? I mean, it's got to be overwhelming.
Yes and yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, it's overwhelming and yes, okay, fine.
Right. So as everyone remembers, pre-9/11, we were kind of naive about these kinds of things. But after 9/11, actually in November of the next year, we had practiced a drill of a dirty bomb being exploded at Logan with hospitals receiving up to 73 casualties all at once. And that drill, that was called Operation Prometheus, was one of several citywide. And there were several more after that, another one called Operation Falcon, where, again, we exercised and prepared people so that drilling really makes a difference. So when this hit, nobody's prepared for this, really. But when this hit, everybody kind of knew the station they were supposed to go to. Everyone knew where they had to be. And there wasn't a lot of yelling. It looked like chaos, but it really was, if this doesn't sound terrible, but it was an elegant dance where everyone knew where they needed to be, and they did it.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking to Dr. Michael Zinner. He's the chief surgeon of Brigham Women's. And if you have questions, and we have thousands, actually, about what happened and what has happened since April 15th, feel free to give him a call.
Let me get back to the blood thing, because I've been reading about this and I'm fascinated by it. So the tourniquet stops the blood, and then they get to the physicians at the emergency room. What do you do? Do you cauterize the wound? I mean, how do you stop that bleeding so the person does not bleed to death?
So the wound, the tourniquet is in place.
Right.
We've started an IV, and this is, again, one of those things we learned from both Afghanistan and Iraq. I can come back to about how we've improved transfusions. The decision is made, patient's got to go right to the operating room. That tourniquet stays on, patient goes down to the operating room, and let's just say it's one extremity. Then nothing is done to that tourniquet until that patient is asleep, on the table, everybody's ready, then slowly let go and you get control of the bleeding one at a time. In some of those patients, we had to complete the amputation that was partial, and in some, it was already complete. But you have to be prepared to let that tourniquet go when you're ready. at the head of the table.
And is one of the big factors how long the patient is without blood in that extremity? Say that their leg was injured, but it was hanging on there, for lack of a more elegant term. If they had been without blood for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, I mean...
Dr. Zinner is smiling at Marjorie like she would have been a great medical student. Isn't that
well,
what you're
that's
thinking?
That's absolutely true.
I knew it was. I could see it in your face.
By it.
You're dead on. So this was the debate a decade ago about the use of tourniquets or not tourniquets. If you put it on, you stop blood flow. What about the good tissue? Because you're cutting off blood flow to that one too. But what we learned in Iraq and Afghanistan is it's more important to stop the bleeding than it is to worry about the rest. Now, what you have to do with the rest is once you restore the blood flow is you got to make sure that what tissue is alive and, if you will, what tissue is not. And you have to remove that dead tissue. But you were right on. That debate waged until... frankly, until Afghanistan and Iraq.
Can
just
I say
one more question,
well,
one more question about the blood. I wonder, too, if you are a young person whose arteries are in better shape than someone who's 70, does that matter?
Oh, absolutely. So if you think about somebody who's smokes too much, overweight, you know, has a lot of underlying conditions, their arteries are like rocks. So try to compress a rock as compared to trying to prevent compress a normal, healthy artery,
wow.
And you can stop it. And that's why we've saved so many of these battlefield casualties, because they're young, healthy men. And now, you know, they carry – the infantry carries with them a tourniquet so that they can apply to themselves or to –
the individual soldier does?
Yes, that's correct.
Wow.
Okay. I'm not ready for medical school, unlike Marjorie. But when someone has a limb amputated, unless they visually – and they're conscious – and unless they visually acknowledge, see that I don't have a leg anymore, don't have an arm, do they feel an absence of a limb, or do they just feel pain, or what is it that they feel?
Early on, they just feel the pain because the nerves have been either destroyed or they've been injured, so they feel the pain. But they also may feel, if you will, that I can't feel my foot. I don't know why, but I can't feel my mm-hmm. foot. Because that sensation has been cut off. There are no longer those impulses, you know, traveling up to the brain. But a lot of these patients were not conscious enough early on to even know that.
Let me ask you a couple of more questions that have been consuming me. I know that the younger brother was treated at Beth Israel, not at your place. Have you ever been – I'm sure some of your doctors have been, if you haven't. Some of them have been interviewed about – I don't know if it's been anonymously or by name – about what it's like treating someone who allegedly is part of a mass murder and huge injury. I understand ethically what your responsibility is, but when you're confronted with that kind of situation, how does one – do the life-saving that you're trained to do and you raise your right hand or whatever you did when you took the oath. How do you do that?
Well, you go into automatic mode because you can't think about, is this a good guy or a bad guy? Now, I wasn't at Beth Israel for this one, but I have been in emergency rooms where there have been shootings between cops and bad guys. And for whatever reason, I always ended up with the bad guys. But I couldn't. You know, it wasn't like I could stop because I couldn't say, hey, how bad a guy are you? Or, you know, did we really get this right? But I remember a number of times where I trained in Baltimore, and it was an inner city hospital, and that occurred all the time. In fact, it would occur in the emergency room. There'd be a shooting in the emergency room.
Ooh.
And you'd be, you know, clearly one of the
bad guys. You know who the perp is and who
yeah.
So you really almost go into automatic pilot because, you know, if you do think that even though you're going to do your job, there's some psychological disconnect kind of thing. That's the voice, by the way, of Dr. Michael Zinner, who is the chief surgeon at Brigham and Women's.
We're reading all about as well, Doctor, these repeated surgeries that people are in some cases going through. Now, what's that about? Is that you're repairing the blood vessels and you're repairing the soft tissue? Or what are the repeated surgeries?
So let's take the example of the – most of the patients had lower extremity injuries like an IED explosion. And so the first day, the first thing you do is stop the bleeding, get everything under control, and clean out the tissue. But – or clean out that limb from the dirt. But you really can't do it all the first time. So what we – the fancy word for it is debridement, because we don't know what's alive and what's dead.
Okay.
So we'd rather err on the side of everything is alive, but we know within 24 hours some tissue is going to declare itself. So by next day, we're going to take them back and take away the dead stuff. And we may need to do that two or three times. The wounds also are wide open. So we – wash them out to make sure that they have the better opportunity to heal. And we've had patients that have gone to the operating room virtually every day to do that. Now, last Saturday at our place, we organized a team of plastic surgeons to be able to move some healthy tissue to, from one part of the body to the part that was injured so that there'd be, if you will, skin coverage and muscle coverage. Those operations take 8 to 9 hours. So we organized five operating rooms worth of plastic surgeons to do those kinds of operations. We waited till Saturday so it didn't interfere with, you know, if you will, the regular operation, and we'd cleaned out everything by then.
I read something about a new technique using a vacuum device. Mm-hmm. What's that?
So it's the fancy name is a vac sponge. So if you can imagine sort of hooking up your vacuum cleaner to a sponge and then putting that on top of a wound, and what it does is it creates negative pressure on the wound that allows the sides of the tissue to come closer together, and it heals faster.
That's amazing. How big is it?
So
this is a love fest like I've never seen it. I mean, if we could have video of Dr. Zinner and Marjorie Egan going back, this is incredible.
Your vacuum cleaner at home is pretty big. This is
I would say the size of a toaster.
Okay.
And it's hooked up by tubes to the wound.
Give time for coffee with her at 2 o'clock. Can you stick her? Let me ask you a question that, if I may, that I'm going to try to phrase it as sensitively as I can. Since the initial 176, I think it was, I'm not sure what the exact number of injured was, but somewhere in the 170s, we read that a couple of days later, an additional 90 people, give or take, came in. Did any of them come to your place?
They did.
Okay, here's the sensitive question. What we read was that there were most of the people were people who said, I had an injury, but I was pretty convinced I could deal with it myself, an eardrum thing or whatever. We learned after 9/11, this is the sensitive part, that a lot of people, when they heard there was money to be had, decided all of a sudden I was injured when they didn't think they were injured before. Are there any concerns, not about the original arrivals, but about the late arrivals, about whether or not these are legitimate injuries or whether or not there's some other thing going on?
You know, I don't think we saw that kind of activity. I really don't. I the folks we saw that came in, a number of them had blast injuries to their eardrums. It's one of those
the
things.
The subsequent group, the additional
that's
part
correct.
Of your. Okay, fine.
They had a sudden loss of hearing and they didn't know why. And it turns out there's two different reasons you can lose your hearing after a blast injury. One of them is you literally rupture your eardrum. And that's a physical one. And the other one is a neurologic one. And so for the physical one, where there's a hole in your eardrum, there's nothing to do but wait. Mm-hmm. On the other one, there's actually medicine to give them, like steroids. And if you give them steroids early on, you can prevent some permanent hearing loss. So that's the kind of thing we saw after the incident.
One last question for me, Dr. Zinner. We've also read that some of these patients are going to get their prosthetic devices and are talking about actually running in the Boston Marathon next year. One woman who's a ballroom dancer talked about going on Dancing with the Stars. Is that possible or is that just pipe dreaming?
Well, it's going to take a lot of rehab. I wouldn't say it's – you know, once I saw that guy from South Africa in the Olympics.
Oh, yeah, the Blade Runner.
Yeah, I saw him it made me aware of the miracle things we can do with modern prosthetics. Having said that, it's still going to take a lot of work for these folks to come back.
Dr. Zinner, congratulations on the work you've done, and we really appreciate your time. From Brigham and Women, he's the chief surgeon, and you and your colleagues really did extraordinary work. It's amazing.
It's a
She's
cliche.
Too old for medical school, by the way.
No,
she
no,
is,
I'm going to stay and have coffee.
Okay, fine. We'll see you outside. Okay. Dr. Zinner, thanks so
Thank
much.
Thank you
that was
so
great.
Much for being here. Okay, it's one thing to come out of the closet, but what about doing that in the locker room? Professional basketball player Jason Collins has announced he is gay. He's the first male professional athlete to do this. Is this groundbreaking or a sad commentary that doing something like this in the 21st century is such a big deal? That's next on Boston Public Radio.
Immigration reform, gun control, sequestration, job creation. There's been a lot on President Obama's agenda in the first 100 days of his second term. How's he handling it all? Guests from both political parties assess the president's batting average on the issues. Next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Payne Boucher Fine Builders, 30 years of building, restoring, and renovating homes in New England. Committed to sustainability. More information available online at pbbuilders.com. And Northeastern University, where faculty, students, and alumni turn innovative ideas into solutions and solutions into economic growth and prosperity. Learn how at northeastern.edu.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We would all agree the world changed in a pretty sad way 2 weeks, I guess, and a day ago on Boylston Street in Boston. Yesterday, the world changed again, but in a way that many feel was great and long overdue. Here's Jason Collins, former Celtic, talking to George Stephanopoulos. Collins said he waited for other players to come out too, but then just went ahead and did it.
I never set out to be the first, and it's, you're sort of waiting around for somebody else to, raise their hand, and, I'm ready to raise my hand, but, you still look around like, okay, come on, guys.
Joining us in studio is a guy who had his own Jason Collins moment. I guess you could argue Jason Collins had a Steve Buckley moment. Steve Buckley came out in the Boston Herald in January of 2011. Steven, it's great to see you. Appreciate it.
Great to be here, guys. How you doing?
Great.
Great. So let me this isn't such a big deal when it's a woman. We've had it a lot before. Billie Jean King, right. Martina Navratilova, I always mispronounce her name, Cheryl Swoops, the basketball player. Mm-hmm. But the NBA and the NFL for men is sort of the ultimate machismo kind of thing. Is that what makes this sort of such a big deal?
It's the alleged ultimate machismo thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of us are sort of latching on to a belief that no longer exists, that the locker room is the last bastion of homophobia. And that's not the case. And I know this because I've been out for 2 years and I've been in locker rooms for 2 years, I mean, all across the country, and talked to athletes for a living. And they'll know that I'm gay. No one said anything. And in fact, I've had quite a few conversations off the record with athletes who are dying to have an openly gay teammate because they've already made the accommodation in their own lives.
Really?
Were you nervous when you first walked into a locker room after January 11th?
Oh, yeah.
What were you saying to yourself?
I mean, the first time I went in there, it's actually a funny story, is that I went in there and it was very uneventful. It was the Patriots in the week leading up to the Jets playoff game. And that I got word that Robert Kraft, who's someone I know very well, wanted to come down and say hi. He comes down a minute before the locker room is closed, and we have to be out of there. And he comes up, he starts talking to me, and I said, Robert, it's great seeing you, but I can't be in here anymore. And he said, and this is a true story, who said you can't be in here? You tell that person to come to me. And I said, no, it's noontime, the locker room's closed. And then there's a pregnant pause, and he goes, oh, okay, well,
get out of
lunch.
Here. Yeah. That's the voice of Steve Buckley, great columnist for the Boston Herald. Our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to talk to Steve about the historic moment yesterday when Jason Collins' face appeared on the cover of SI.
Do you think it's different? I mean, it's obviously different now than if you had come out 10 years ago, 20 years ago. You wouldn't have been able to come out then, would you?
It's a question I get asked a lot, and it's a question I don't have an answer to. I understand where you're going in that times have changed dramatically in the last 10 years. So in that spirit, I will say, yes, it would have been more difficult. I can only talk about the actual historical record, which is that I came out 2 years ago and that everybody was cool in the gang about it, and my life has been great. 10 years ago, that's like walking the line.
Yeah.
15, 20 years ago, then we're talking getting beat up in the parking lot, but it's been fine.
When you were in the closet, how hard was it for you to walk those two? Because it is, sports writers.
Yeah.
They're the macho guys covering the more macho guys.
I would ask you to talk to Tony Maserati, Sean McAdam, the guys that I work with in the press box, because they all knew that I was gay. And they told me this later on because I'm kind of proud. This is one thing I can brag on myself, is that I never played the the game, in that when I was on the radio or TV and the hot intern walked in and everyone, oh, wow, look at that. Like, and I never did that because I've always felt that that closeted gay guys who try to sound that way, they don't have a practiced rap when it comes to that. So what they do is they latch on to old lines from movies like, hey, she's a real dish. I could go for her. And when you hear it, it doesn't sound right. And so I always stayed away from that.
Our number is 877-301-8970. I got to speak to you last night, Steve Buckley. I have to say, when you were talking about your own experience, I felt really good. And I'm saying to myself, well, maybe the world is ready for things I'm not convinced they're ready for. But there is a flip side. We're going to play two clips back to back. First voice is basketball analyst from ESPN, Chris Broussard, yesterday. The second is this San Francisco 49ers cornerback, Chris Gulliver, right before the Super Bowl. And listen to what they had to say about, well, in Broussard's case, about Jason Collins, in Culliver's case, about gays in the locker room in general. Listen to this.
I don't believe that you can live an openly homosexual lifestyle or an openly premarital sex between heterosexuals. If you're openly living that type of lifestyle, then the Bible says you know them by their fruits. It says that, you know, that's a sin.
I don't do the gay guys, man. I don't do that. No.
Are there any on the 49ers?
Nah.
Stop the tape.
They don't got no gay people on the team. You know, they got to get up out of here.
Can we stop
the tape? Can't be with that sweet stuff.
So is Culliver, forget Broussard, because I guess Broussard was upset when he says premarital sex. He's just doing a religious thing for whatever it is. Is Culliver the outlier as far as you're concerned, the 49er guy?
He's the noise.
Yeah, meaning what?
He's the Ben Chapman in the Jackie Robinson story. He's the guy just on the top step of the dugout making a lot of dumb noise. And who the hell is he? How does he know who's gay and who's not gay in the San Francisco 49ers locker room? He's dumb and uninformed, and that's what it comes down to. And Broussard's a smart guy. I mean, he really knows his stuff, and he's a very good writer. And his entire rant is religious-based. Now, I happen to believe in God very fervently, and I just know that my God is okay with me. I don't know who his God is. I assume that both our gods are the same person. But I received 4,000-plus emails when I came out. 98% of them were positive. Even the ones that were negative were along the lines of, do we really need to talk about this? And, you know, like that. The handful of really nasty homophobic ones, when you receive a lot of really cool emails from people, and then all of a sudden you open one up and it's like, oh, my gosh. Well, it just looks, it's noise. It just looks silly, and you just move past it.
877-301-8970. That's the voice of Steve Buckley. We're talking about Jason Collins, former Celtic, 12 years in the NBA. He's a free agent now, coming out yesterday in Sports Illustrated. Kristen, you're in Westford, and you are next on Boston Public Radio with Steve Buckley and the two of us. Hey, Kristen.
Hey, how's it going?
Great.
All right, yeah, Matt, let me correct you from the beginning. Someone on your station was calling basketball and football the ultimate machismo sports.
That was Marjorie Egan. What's that?
Yeah, no, hockey, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Because, well, start there, please.
Yeah, I stand corrected, Kristen. I should have said hockey.
That
basketball. Oh, but anyway, okay. And then on the way down, I was listening to talk radio, and they were comparing this guy who came out to Jackie Robinson, being the first black, professional baseball player, the groundbreaker. And I've got to say, this is so silly, because what Mr. Robinson was something he couldn't hide. He was black. He can't hide that. He can't decide not to be. And he just went forward in a world that hated him.
If I could just jump in, if you Google my name and Jackie Robinson in ESPN the magazine, I wrote that exact story 2 years ago. And it goes actually deeper than that, beyond the fact that Jackie Robinson couldn't hide the fact that he was black, as opposed to closeted gay athletes. Jackie Robinson walks into a Brooklyn Dodgers clubhouse in 1947 to a room filled with people who had no black friends or black family members they'd care to admit to, as opposed to the gay athlete who walks into a locker room filled with people who have gay friends, gay family members, and so on.
Right.
Jackie had to wait for them to come around. These athletes in 2013 have been waiting for Jason Collins to come around.
Right. As long as we clarify that. I was going to say, I don't think that, gay marriage should be okay, and that's my faith. And, you know, I know there are a lot of conservophobic people out there, but that's how I believe. I have an uncle who passed away who was definitely gay, and we have an aunt now on the other side of the family who we know is. We don't talk about it, and I love her, and I love him. But that would be like promoting my other uncle who's an alcoholic, saying, you know, hey, don't be against alcoholism. You know, you got to hate the guy. You love the guy.
Well,
alcoholism and gay? I don't know.
Okay, we'll leave it, Kristen. We'll leave it there. But thank you so much for the call. 877-301-8970. So he's a free agent. So if it turns out he doesn't, he's been around 12 years. He's not a great player. Doc Rivers said yesterday, coach of Celtics, a great team player. He's a pro's pro kind of thing. So if it turns out that he isn't picked up by anybody in the NBA, I don't know if there are 30 teams or whatever there are, is the line going to be, well, he would have been picked up as a journeyman, but he's not picked up because despite all the rhetoric from David Stern, the commissioner, nobody wants a gay guy on their team in their locker room.
It's a fair question. And I don't have an answer to it because the drama hasn't played out yet. What we do know is that he is a free agent and that he is a, I'll be kind and say he's a role player, a working man. There are all kinds of ways to describe a guy who bounces around from team to team. He is that guy.
You know him, by the way? Did you know
nope.
him when he was a Celtic?
Nope.
Okay.
No, I was in the same room with him a few times when I did some Celtics games, but I may have asked him a question or two, but I don't recall. And I feel like I know him so well now because I've read all these stories about what a great guy he is the last couple of days.
You know, we presume that there are a lot of other professional athletes in football, basketball,
yes.
and hockey. I'll give it as machismo do now. Hockey is a very tough sport that are gay, that are still in the closet. Do you think this is going to inspire other people who are still actively playing in the middle of their, you know, contract on the same team kind of deal?
I hope so. What's going to happen is that, and listen, common sense tells us that there are closet gay athletes in the four major sports. I presume that what they're doing right now is auditing this entire situation. They're monitoring what's happening and they're reading. I guarantee they're Googling every single story written about this gentleman and they're seeing how it plays out and they want to know if the water is fine. And most of it is fine, but you read the Broussard stuff, and that might give an athlete, "Ooh, I don't want to suffer those slings and arrows."
Yeah.
So we have to wait and see what happens. But if I had to go one way or the other, common sense tells me that, given the reception he's been receiving, except for the noise, given the reception that he's been receiving the last couple of days, my hunch is that more athletes will come out.
You know, I wonder whether in football you see, and I'm painting with a broad brush, but you see a lot of...
I think you know more sports than you give yourself credit for. You're playing this little, you know, little Nell on the farm.
That's
but
right.
you know your sports.
I call her Nell off the air, actually. It's funny you should say that,
farm.
Steve.
But,
hey, Nell, continue.
I was talking about the religious thing. I mean, I don't think of the NBA and the as being really, really openly religious, kind of the way I think of football, because you see the guys, especially in college football, they're praying to the Lord before the game begins.
What
the
are you talking? The guys on the foul line are crossing themselves all the time, big time.
Well, okay, but they're the Catholics, and they're not the evangelicals, the born again Christians, like you see the Tim Tebow types. They're down south. That's where I think the football players in those southern. I'm again painting with a broad brush, but Boston is much more friendly to gays and lesbians than, you know, Alabama is.
I was just at Bruins practice and I was talking with a bunch of writers out in the hallway waiting for the locker room to open after practice. And we were talking, did you think it would be a basketball player first? Because we've all been playing this gay parlor game, as I mentioned in the Herald today, as to who it would be and what sport it would be. And you could talk to 20 different writers or media people and get 20 different – one guy says basketball, football, hockey, baseball. Another guy says no, baseball, hockey, football, baseball, you know, like that. I thought it would be hockey, actually. I thought the first openly gay player would be hockey. Mainly because of Patrick Burke and the You Can Play Project. Brian Burke was general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs. His son Brendan came out in college.
Okay.
And it was his dream to pave the way for openly gay athletes. That's what he wanted his career to be. And then he was killed in a car accident. The entire Burke family rallied to this cause. Their baby brother, their son, had come out and was killed in a car accident. And Patrick, who's a scout with the Philadelphia Flyers, and he's in law school. He lives in the North End. He's a dear friend of mine. He has done so much with the You Can Play Project, and they've done so much in all sports, but it is certainly hockey-centric because of the Burke family. And I thought that might, if I had to guess, and it was strictly a guess, I thought maybe a hockey player would be first.
You know what I love about what you just said before the Burke story, and we talk about you talking to your fellow sports writers. You know, when you tune into sports radio, a common question is, okay, who's going to win the next championship? Is it the Pats? Is it the Bruins? And now it's who's going to be the first sport where a guy comes out. I ask you, I assume you know a lot of gays who are obviously closeted gays in professional sports, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what are we talking about? Are we talking about serious numbers of people or no?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I just know the names. That
superstars? Any superstars?
No, but I mean, it's...
Do you want to spell a name backwards, Dave?
No athlete has confided in me personally, so I want to debunk that right now. But I think the names, if I were so inclined to throw names out, they'd be the same names that the straight writers know because it's all through innuendo. And, well, I heard that this guy did this and that and, you know, and so forth. So as to the actual numbers, it's probably in keeping with mainstream society.
Do you think this, you know, this guy who I've never met, and frankly, I'm embarrassed to say I probably almost never heard of him until yesterday. I probably knew the name from when he was with the Celtics. It seems to me that since people in this country are so sports obsessed, that even though he's not a huge star, that somebody having the courage like that, who seems like a terrific soul when you just read about him, doesn't that trickle down and create greater acceptance and tolerance? I don't know if I mentioned this to you yesterday. I'm not saying it was a seismic shift, but everybody liked Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody. And, you know, it's sort of like, well, my God, you know, Michael Jordan is this fabulous guy. He's a black. It seems to me that helped in some small way with race relations in this country. Does the Collins thing matter beyond sports? Does it matter in larger society?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And what it does is, and he mentioned this himself, it begins the conversation. It makes it easier for dad to come home from work or mom to the closeted son or daughter that maybe they know or think might be, and they're trying to find a comfortable way to bring up the discussion over the dinner table. And you might say, hey, did you hear about this basketball player who came out today? And you might get a dialogue going. Next thing you know, you've got an openly gay son or daughter, and life is a lot easier. And it really is that simple.
Well, the other thing, the reason I mentioned the whole macho thing of football and basketball, and yes, hockey, put that in there. I mean, to me, I put them sort of next to the Navy SEALs or guys who are in the front line in battle. It's the uber male kind of thing.
Well, let me,
I think it makes it – professional sports
Buckley's
makes a
about
difference.
To smack her down. I can tell
away
it's coming.
A gay
stereotype. Let me tell you a story. I tell it banquets, and it's a true story. Swear to God. There's a guy in New York, good friend of mine, who's a writer. His name's John Shear. He works for ESPN now. He used to write for Sports Illustrated. He's gay. I'm gay. We're in New York one night. He wanted to see a Broadway show. As it happened, Brad Little was a dear friend of mine who ended up playing the Phantom on Broadway, the Phantom at the time.
Wow.
He was in the chorus of Fiddler on the Roof with Topol on Broadway. So let's go see Fiddler on the Roof, and we'll take Brad out. It was 1992. Brad is straight, married. I know his wife, Barbara. The three of us went out and talked about the NBA for an hour and a half. And then we walked to the corner and we went our separate ways. I hugged Brad. See you later. Nice talking to you. Talk to you again. John Shear and I walked up 8th Avenue, whatever it was. And I turned to John and I said, do you realize that what happened here tonight? He says, what? Something happened tonight that has probably never happened in the entire history of the human race. And he said, what's that? And I said, two gay sports writers went out drinking with a straight chorus boy.
That's right.
And I always use that as my example of stereotypes and about how you never know.
Yeah, that's absolutely great.
And that is a true story.
Let's take a couple calls. The voice you hear here is Steve Buckley, great columnist, sports columnist for the great Boston Herald, where Marjorie also is a fine columnist in the other half of the paper.
Thank you, Jim.
This is incredible. Go ahead, take it away, Marjorie. Go.
Alma from Somerville, thank you for calling, what are we?
Boston Public Radio.
Thank you very much.
Hi. I just wanted to bring out a point that hasn't been talked about, but I think that this hopefully will help. Everything, I think, is a continuum, and every little bit helps. But the one difference that I think gay people have that, well, certainly I don't think black people have, is that black people don't have to tell their parents they're black. And I think it's very difficult, especially for young men, to tell their parents, especially at the most difficult time now, I think, is for really conservative religious people who think that it's a sin against God. And that's still a very difficult thing. And I'm hoping that this kind of thing will help move everything along a little bit more.
That's a great point, Alma. Thank you very much for calling. Laura from Scituate, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. You're on with Steve Buckley. Hi, Laura.
Hello, Steve Buckley. It's Laura Raposa. I miss you.
Hey,
oh my God. Laura!
For those who don't remember the last name, this is half of what used to be the great Inside Track. Hey, Laura, take it away.
Tell Laura I love her.
Oh, thank you, Steve. I'm calling as a listener, as I am, as you know, Marjorie, to your show.
Thank you.
And I was talking with a high school wrestler the other day, and somehow we got on the subject of gay wrestlers, and I was horrified by what came out of his mouth, and that was, no. Nobody wants a gay wrestler. Nobody would want to wrestle a gay wrestler. Nobody would talk to him. Nobody would. And I was so horrified by this. And I said to him, does everybody think like this? And he said, well, yeah, you know. Steve, is there some way of getting into the high school and telling these kids and educating these kids? Because, you know, this kid went to Catholic school, and I was just horrified by what he said to me.
Well,
and there's got to be a way of getting these high school athletes early and get them talking about this early on, because that at some point, maybe, hopefully, they'll be professional athletes and they can take what they learn in high school from people talking to them about gays and gays sports people. And I was horrified. And I'm hoping that there's somebody out there that is designing a program for high school kids.
Laura, thanks for the call. That was a great call.
Good to talk to you, Laura.
Thanks for listening.
I'm more of an optimist. I don't know the wrestler in question, obviously. And I think that I spoke at Manchester Essex Regional High School 2 years ago. Paul Murphy, the principal up there, set up a great program. He had the entire school in attendance. And I spoke, Ann Gifford, Chad Gifford's wife from Bank of America, set up the program. And Chad and Ann were both in attendance. And I spoke. At the end of my talk, a whole bunch of students came up to the lip of the stage to say, hi, how are you, and so forth. And I noticed that there was one male student sort of standing off to the side. And I kept seeing him out of the corner of my eye as I was and he looked pensive. And there were two girls standing behind him. And at one point, one of the girls kind of pushed him a little bit and said, go ahead. And he stepped up, and there were 25 students all standing around. And over 1,000 students had been in attendance. And he stood up, and he came out to me in front of all his friends.
Wow.
And it was a really, really cool moment. And in Mr. Murphy at Manchester Essex Regional High School, the program, the work that they've done up there, he told me that during that summer, a parent came to school and talked to him and said, I just want you to know that my son came out during the summer. So I just wanted you to be aware of that for when school opens in September. And he said, oh, well, what made this all happen? And the parent said, well, they had a great talk after I spoke. It wasn't me. It was the students all began talking. It led to a dialogue. It's all about dialogue and conversation. If you read the SI piece in which Jason Collins comes out, he talks about beginning the conversation. I would slightly disagree in that the conversation has been ongoing, but he has revved up the volume. It's all about dialogue and conversation.
Steve Buckley, you had a good day yesterday, yes?
A busy day. It was fun. I was so happy when I saw that because I've been waiting for this. I did say when I came out 2 years ago, I said, we will have an open league athlete within 3 years. So I have a year now to play with because I'm off the hook now.
You're a better predictor than I. Steve Buckley from the Boston Herald, we really appreciate your time. Steve, it's great to see you.
What, are we done?
We're done, Margaret.
I thought
you were about to say something to your colleague.
I was not about to say something, except that he looks very good in the videos. Very handsome guy.
That's
Steve
all
Buckley.
Margaret cares about.
Some
Steve
people,
Buckley
you know,
walks
look better
in the studio,
with age, and some people don't.
Why are you looking at me, Margaret? In any case, everybody, thanks for listening today. We appreciate it. You can find us on the web 24/7, wgbhnews.org/BPR. Please go out and vote. Tomorrow we're going to do an election postmortem, and we're going to talk about a horrible story out of BU. Student died after a fire in Alston in an illegal rooming house. We're going to talk about who dropped the ball there and whether or not this kid's life could have been saved. Thanks so much for being here. Again, please vote. Marjorie doesn't agree with me, but I would suggest you vote anyway. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
We'll see you tomorrow at noon. Thanks.